History's Book 4, Melpomene. After the capture of Babylon, Darius himself led a campaign against the Scythians. Since Asia was flourishing with men and great wealth was being amassed, Darius desired to punish the Scythians because they had been the first to invade Median territory and, defeating those who opposed them in battle, had begun the wrongdoing. For the Scythians had ruled Upper Asia for 28 years, as I have said before. They had invaded Asia in pursuit of the Sumerians and had put an end to the rule of the Medes, for the Medes had ruled Asia before the Scythians arrived. But the Scythians, after being away 28 years and returning to their own land after so long a time, found awaiting them a task no less than the one against the Medes. They discovered an army opposing them that was not small. For the wives of the Scythians, since their men had been away for so long, had been consorting with the slaves. The Scythians blind all their slaves, on account of the milk which they drink, doing it in this way. Taking bone pipes very much like flutes, they insert these into the genitals of the mares and blow with their mouths, while others milk as the others blow. They say they do this for the following reason. The veins of the mare become filled by the blowing, and her udder is drawn down. When they have milked the milk, they pour it into hollow wooden vessels, and stationing the blind men around the vessels, they stir the milk, and the part of it that rises to the top they skim off and consider more valuable, while what settles below is thought inferior to the other. For these reasons, the Scythians blind every slave they take, for they are not farmers but nomads. From these slaves, then, and the women, a generation of young men was raised. And when these learned of their own origin, they took up arms against the returning Scythians as they came back from the Medes. First they cut off the land, digging a wide trench running from the Tauric Mountains to Lake Meotes, which is very large. And afterward, when the Scythians tried to force their way in, they camped opposite them and fought. Battle occurred many times, and since the Scythians could gain no advantage in the fighting, one man among them spoke up. "What are we doing, men of Scythia? By fighting our own slaves, we ourselves become fewer as we are killed, and by killing them, we will rule over fewer in the future. Now it seems best to me that we set aside spears and bows, and each man take the whip of his horse and go closer to them. For as long as they saw us bearing weapons, they thought themselves equal to us and born of equals. But when they see us carrying whips instead of weapons, they will realize that they are our slaves, and acknowledging this, they will not stand their ground." Hearing this, the Scythians did as he said, and the slaves, astonished at what was happening, forgot the fighting and fled. Thus the Scythians ruled Asia, and, driven out again by the Medes, returned to their own land in this manner. It was for these reasons that Darius, wishing to punish them, gathered an army against them. Now, as the Scythians tell it, theirs is the youngest of all nations, and it came about in this way. The first man to exist in this land, which was then a wasteland, was named Targitaus, and the parents of this Targitaus, they say, though I do not find this credible, yet they say it were Zeus and a daughter of the river Borysthenes. From such a lineage Targitaus was born, and to him were born three sons, Lipixes, Arpixes, and the youngest, Colixes. While these were ruling, golden objects fell from the sky into Scythian territory, a plow, a yoke, an axe, and a cup. The eldest, seeing them first, wished to approach and take them, but as he came near, the gold began to burn. When he withdrew, the second approached, and the same thing happened to him again. So the burning gold repelled these two, but when the third, the youngest, approached, the fire went out, and he carried the gold objects to his own home. And the elder brothers, acknowledging this, handed over the entire kingship to the youngest. From Lipixes, they say, are descended those Scythians called the Aucati. From the middle brother, Arpixes, come the Caesari together with the Traspians, and the youngest of the three, the king, fathered those called the Paralati. Altogether they are called Scoloti, after the name of the king. The Greeks called them Scythians. This, then, is how the Scythians say they came to be, and as for the years since they came into being, they say the total from the first king, Targitaus, to Darius's crossing against them is no more than 1,000 years, but exactly that many. This sacred gold the kings guard most carefully, and with great sacrifices they propitiate it and visit it every year. Whoever, having charge of the sacred gold in the festival, falls asleep in the open air, that man, the Scythians say, does not live out the year. And for this reason he is given as much land as he can ride around on horseback in a single day. Since the land was vast, Kolaxis established three kingdoms for his own sons and made one of these the greatest, in which the gold is kept safe. As for the regions further up toward the North Wind, they say it is not possible for the neighboring peoples of that land to see or pass through any farther, on account of feathers that have been scattered about. For both the earth and the air there are full of feathers, and these are what block the view. This is what the Scythians say about themselves and the land to the north of them. But the Greeks who dwell on the Black Sea tell it this way. Heracles, driving the cattle of Geryon, came to this land, which was then a wasteland, the very land the Scythians now inhabit. Geryon lived outside the Black Sea, dwelling on what the Greeks call the island of Erythea near Gadara, beyond the pillars of Heracles on the ocean. As for the ocean, they say in tradition that it begins from the rising of the sun and flows around the whole earth, but they do not prove this by any deed. From there it was that Heracles reached the land now known as Scythia, and being overtaken by winter and frost, he wrapped himself in his lion's skin and fell asleep. And in that time his horses, which were grazing free from the chariot, vanished by some divine chance. When Heracles awoke, he searched for them, and going over the whole land, at last came to the land called Hylia. There he found in a cave a creature that was half woman, a two-formed viper, whose upper parts from the buttocks were those of a woman, and whose lower parts were those of a snake. Seeing her and marveling, he asked her if she had anywhere seen wandering mares. Her reply was that she had them in her own keeping and would return them to him only after he lay with her. And Heracles agreed to the union for this payment. She, however, kept postponing the return of the horses, wishing to remain as long as possible with Heracles, while he wished to recover them and depart. At last, giving them back, she said, "These mares that came here I have kept safe for you, and you have paid the price of their safe keeping, for I have from you three sons. Tell me what I should do with these when they grow to manhood, whether I should settle them here myself, since I hold power over this land, or send them to you." So she asked him this, and he, they say, replied to this. "When you see the boys grown to manhood, you would not go wrong doing as follows. Whichever of them you see drawing this bow in this manner and girding himself with this belt in this way, make him the inhabitant of this land. But whichever fails to accomplish these tasks that I command, send him out of the land. Doing this, you yourself will be pleased, and you will carry out what I have instructed." So saying, he loosed one of his bows. Up to that time Heracles had carried two, and displayed the belt to her, then handed over the bow and the belt, a small golden cup hung at the tip of its clasp. And once he gave them to her, he went on his way. She, when the sons born to her had grown to manhood, first gave them names, to one of them Agathiasis, to the one following Gelonus, and to the youngest Scythes, and then, remembering the instructions, she did as she had been told. And indeed two of her sons, Agathiasis and Gelonus, proved unable to accomplish the appointed task and were driven out of the land by their mother, and departed. But the youngest of them, Scythes, accomplished it and remained in the land. And from Scythes, son of Heracles, are descended all the kings who have ever been of the Scythians, and from the cup, even to this day, the Scythians wear cups hanging from their belts. This alone the mother contrived for Scythes. This is what the Greeks who dwell on the Black Sea say. But there is also another story, to which I myself am most inclined. That the nomadic Scythians who dwelt in Asia, pressed hard in war by the Massageti, departed, crossing the river Araxes for the land of the Cimmerians, for the land the Scythians now inhabit is said in old times to have belonged to the Cimmerians. And that the Cimmerians, as the Scythians advanced, took counsel, since a great army was coming against them. And their opinions were divided, both sides being firm, but that of the kings was the better. For the opinion of the common people was that it was best to withdraw and not risk danger for the sake of dust, while that of the kings was to fight to the death for the land against those advancing. Neither the common people were willing to be persuaded by the kings, nor the kings by the common people. The people resolved to withdraw and hand over the land to the invaders without a fight, while the kings decided to lie dead in their own land rather than flee together with the people, considering how many good things they had enjoyed and how many evils they might expect from fleeing their fatherland, to overtake them. When this seemed best to them, they split into two equal groups and fought each other. All those who died at their own hands were buried by the people of the Cimmerians beside the river Tiras, and their tomb is still visible there. And having buried them, they made their way out of the country. And the Scythians, coming upon it, took the land, now empty of people. And to this day there are in Scythia Cimmerian walls and Cimmerian ferries, and there is also a place named Cimmeria, and there is a Cimmerian Bosporus, so called. It is clear that the Cimmerians, fleeing the Scythians into Asia, also founded the peninsula on which the Greek city of Sinope now stands. It is also clear that the Scythians, pursuing them, invaded the land of Media, having missed the way. For the Cimmerians always fled along the coast, while the Scythians pursued, keeping the Caucasus on their right, until they invaded the land of Media, having turned inland from their route. This is another account, told in common by Greeks and non-Greeks alike. Aristeas, son of Caestrobius, a man of Proconnesus, said in the verses he composed that he came to the Issodones, having been seized by Apollo's inspiration, and that above the Issodones dwell the one-eyed Arimaspians, and beyond them the gold-guarding Griffins, and beyond these the Hyperboreans, who reach down to the sea. All these peoples, except the Hyperboreans, starting with the Arimaspians, are constantly attacking their neighbors. And it was the Arimaspians who drove the Issodones from their homeland, while the Issodones in turn drove out the Scythians, and the Cimmerians, who dwelt by the southern sea, were pressed by the Scythians and abandoned their land. So even this man does not agree with the Scythians about this land. As for where Aristeas, the man who said these things, was from, I have told. But the account I heard about him in Proconnesus and Cyzicus, I will now tell. They say that Aristeas, a citizen of standing equal to any other, went into a fuller's shop in Proconnesus and died there, and that the fuller, locking up his workshop, went off to inform those close to the dead man. And when the report had already spread through the city that Aristeas had died, a man from Cyzicus arrived from the town of Ardace and disputed with those who said this, claiming that he had met him going toward Cyzicus and had spoken with him. And while this man argued the point vehemently, those related to the deceased showed up at the fuller's premises bringing what was needed to carry away the body. But when the room was opened, Aristeas appeared neither dead nor alive. Then, 7 years later, he appeared in Proconnesus and composed the verses which the Greeks now call the Arimaspia, and having composed them, he vanished a second time. This is what these cities say, but I know what happened among the people of Metapontum in Italy after this second disappearance of Aristeas, 240 years later, as I reckoned by comparing accounts in Proconnesus and Metapontum. The Metapontines say that Aristeas himself appeared to them in their land and commanded them to set up an altar to Apollo, and beside it to place a statue inscribed with the name Aristeas of Proconnesus. For he said that Apollo had come to their land alone among the Italiotes, and that he himself had accompanied him as the Aristeas who is now here. But at that time, when he accompanied the god, he was a crow. And having said this, he vanished, and according to the Metapontines, they dispatched envoys to Delphi to ask the god what this apparition of a man signified. The Pythia told them to obey the apparition, and that if they obeyed, it would go better for them. They accepted this and carried it out. And now there stands a statue bearing the name of Aristeas beside the very image of Apollo, and around it laurel trees stand. The image is set up in the marketplace. Let this much be said about Aristeas. As for the land about which this account has set out to speak, no one knows accurately what lies beyond it. For I am unable to learn anything from anyone who claims to have seen it with his own eyes, for not even Aristeas, whom I mentioned a little before this, not even he claimed in his own verses to have gone beyond the Issodones, but spoke of what lay beyond by hearsay, saying that the Issodones were the ones who told him these things. But as far as we ourselves have been able to reach accurately by hearsay, to the furthest extent, all of it shall be told. From the trading post of the Borysthenites, for this is the most central of all the coastal places of Scythia. From this point the first to dwell are the Callipidi, who are Greek Scythians, and above them another people who are called the Elazones. These and the Callipidi follow the same way of life as the Scythians in other respects, yet they also sow and eat grain, and onions and garlic and lentils and millet. Above the Elazones dwell the Scythian farmers, who do not sow grain for their own food but for sale. Above these dwell the Neuri. North of the Neuri the land is empty of people, as far as we know. These are the peoples situated by the Hypanis River, west of the Borysthenes. But once one crosses the Borysthenes, starting from the sea, the first region is Hylia, and going up from there dwell the Scythian farmers, whom the Greeks who live on the river Hypanis call Borysthenites, though they call themselves Albiopolitans. These farming Scythians occupy the land toward the east for a 3 days' journey, reaching to the river called the Panticapes, and toward the north a voyage of 11 days up the Borysthenes. Beyond these there is already a great expanse of empty land. After the empty land dwell the man-eaters, a people distinct in themselves and in no way Scythian. Beyond these the land is already truly empty, and there is no people at all, as far as we know. To the east of these farming Scythians, on crossing the river Panticapes, dwell the nomad Scythians, who neither sow anything at all nor plow. Treeless, this entire territory has except for Hylia. These nomads occupy, toward the east, a 14 days' journey of land stretching to the river Jerhis. Beyond the Jerhis lie the so-called royal lands, and the Scythians there are the best and most numerous, and they consider the other Scythians their slaves. They extend southward to the Tauric land, and eastward to the trench which those born from the blind men dug, and to the trading post on the Maeotic lake called Cremne. Some of them extend as far as the river Tanais. North of the royal Scythians dwell the Black Cloaks, another people, not Scythian. Beyond the Black Cloaks there are lakes, and it is empty of people, as far as we know. Crossing the river Tanais, it is no longer Scythia, but the first district belongs to the Sauromati, who, starting from the recess of the Maeotic lake, occupy toward the north a journey of 15 days, the whole land being bare of both wild and cultivated trees. Above them, holding the second district, dwell the Budini, a land occupying all of it thickly wooded with every kind of tree. North of the Budini there is first an empty stretch of a 7 days' journey, and after the empty land, turning more toward the east, dwell the Thisigeti, a numerous and distinct people. They live by hunting. Adjoining them, settled in the same region, are those called the Eiaci, and these two live by hunting in the following manner. Each man lies in wait, climbing a tree, and trees are dense throughout the whole country, and each man has a horse trained to lie down on its belly for the sake of being low, and a dog ready as well. When he spots the animal from the tree, he shoots it, then mounts up and gives chase on horseback while his dog keeps hold of the quarry. Beyond these, toward the east, turning aside, dwell other Scythians, who broke away from the royal Scythians and so came to this region. As far as the land of these Scythians, all that has been described is flat land and deep-soiled, but from that point on it is stony and rough. Having gone through much of this rough land too, there dwell, at the foot of high mountains, men said to be all bald from birth, both males and females alike, and snub-nosed, and having large chins, speaking their own language, wearing Scythian dress, and living off trees. The name of the tree they live from is Pontic, about the size of a fig tree in size. It bears fruit the size of a bean, which has a stone. When this ripens, they pass it through cloth filters, and liquid runs out from it, a thick black substance. The name of what flows out is ashy. This they both lick and drink mixed with milk, and from the thick sediment of it they make cakes and eat these. For they do not have many sheep, since the pastures there are not good. Each of them lives under a tree, in winter when they cover the tree with a thick white felt, and in summer without the felt. No one harms these people, for they are said to be sacred, nor do they possess any weapon of war. It is these people who settle disputes for those living around them, and moreover, whoever flees for refuge to them is harmed by no one. Their name is the Argipeans. As far as the land of these bald men, there is ample clear knowledge of the land and of the peoples before them. For some of the Scythians reach them, and learning of this is not hard from those Scythians, and also some of the Greeks from the trading post of Borysthenes and from the other trading posts on the Pontus. The Scythians who go to them conduct their business through 7 interpreters and 7 languages. Up to this point, then, it is known, but beyond no one can say for certain what lies beyond the bald men, for high mountains cut off the land, impassable, and no one crosses them. These bald men say, though I do not find them credible, that goat-footed men inhabit the mountains, and that beyond them are other men who sleep half the year through. That claim I reject outright, but the region east of the bald men is known with certainty to be inhabited by the Isidones. What lies further above it, toward the north wind, is not known either to the bald men or to the Isidones, except for what these people themselves report. The Isidones are said to observe the following customs. When a man's father dies, all his relatives bring sheep, and then, having sacrificed them and cut up the meat, they also cut up the dead father of the man receiving them, and mixing all the meat together, they set out a feast. His head, though, they strip of flesh and clean out, then gild it, and thereafter treat it as a sacred image, performing great sacrifices to it every year. A son does this for his father just as the Greeks hold their genesia. In other respects, too, they are said to be a just people, and the women hold equal standing with the men. These people, then, are known, but what lies beyond them, further up, belongs to the Isidones, who say that there are one-eyed men there and gold-guarding griffins. This the Scythians report, having taken it from the Isidones, and from the Scythians the rest of us have adopted it and call them, in the Scythian tongue, Arimaspians, for the Scythians call one Arima and I Spu. This whole region I have described is so extremely harsh in winter that for 8 of the months an unbearable frost sets in, during which pouring out water produces no mud, but lighting a fire does produce mud. The sea freezes, and the whole Cimmerian Bosporus with it, and the Scythians settled within the trench march out onto the ice and drive their wagons across to the Scythians on the other side. So winter continues in this way for 8 months, and for the remaining 4 months it is cold there as well. This winter is unlike, in its character, all the winters that occur in other places. In it, during the season proper for rain, there is scarcely any rain worth mentioning, while in summer it rains without stopping. And whereas elsewhere thunder occurs at that season, there it does not occur then, but is abundant in summer. If thunder happens to occur in winter, it is considered a marvel to be wondered at. So too, if an earthquake occurs, whether in summer or in winter, in Scythia, it is considered a marvel. Horses endure this winter and bear up under it, but mules and donkeys cannot endure it at all, whereas elsewhere horses standing in frost suffer frostbite, while donkeys and mules endure it. It seems to me that the breed of hornless cattle too does not grow horns there for this same reason. My judgment is supported by a line of Homer in the Odyssey, which runs thus. And Libya, where lambs are horned from birth, rightly said, since in hot places horns grow quickly, while in places of severe cold cattle either do not grow horns at all or grow them only with difficulty. There, then, this happens because of the cold. But I marvel, since my account from the start has been seeking out such digressions, over a strange fact. Mules cannot be born anywhere in Elis, even though the climate there isn't cold and no other obvious reason presents itself. The Eleans themselves say that mules are not born among them because of some curse, but that whenever the season arrives when the mares are ready for breeding, the people take them across into the neighboring territories, and there, in the land of their neighbors, they put donkeys to the mares, until the mares are in foal. Then they lead them back home again. As for the feathers which the Scythians say fill the air, and because of which they claim they can neither see nor travel further into the mainland, this is the opinion I hold about them. The region above this land always has snow falling, less in summer than in winter, as is natural. Now whoever has seen thick snow falling close at hand knows what I mean, for snow resembles feathers. And it is because of this winter, being such as it is, that the northern parts of this continent are uninhabited. It is the feathers, then, that I believe the Scythians and their neighbors mean when they liken the snow to them. These, then, are the furthest reaches of which anything is reported. Concerning a people called Hyperboreans, neither the Scythians say anything at all, nor do any of the others settled in that region, except perhaps the Isidones. And as I think, not even they say anything, for otherwise the Scythians too would have spoken of them, as they do about the one-eyed men. But Hesiod has spoken of the Hyperboreans, and so has Homer, in the Epigone, if indeed it was really Homer who composed those verses. By far the most is said about them by the Delians, who claim that offerings wrapped in stalks of wheat are carried out of Hyperborean lands and reach the Scythians, and that from the Scythians, each neighboring people in turn receiving them carries them onward, toward the west, as far as possible, to the Adriatic, and from there, sent southward, the Dodonean Greeks are the first of the Greeks to receive them. From there they go down to the Malian Gulf and cross over to Euboea, and Cytti passes them to Cytti as far as Carystus. From there Andros is skipped, for it is the Carystians who carry them onward to Tenos, and it is the Tenians who bring them to Delos. In this way, then, these sacred offerings are said to arrive at Delos. First, according to the account, two maidens carried the offerings from the Hyperboreans, whom the Delians name Hyperosh and Laiatis. And along with them, for their safety, the Hyperboreans sent 5 men of their own citizens as escorts, those who are now called the Perfores and hold great honors at Delos. But when those sent out by the Hyperboreans failed to return home, the Hyperboreans took this hard, thinking it would always be their fate, whenever they sent people out, never to get them back. And so they took to carrying the sacred offerings, bound up in wheat straw, to their borders, and charged their neighbors to send them onward out of their own land to another people. And thus passed on from people to people, these offerings, they say, arrive at Delos. I myself know of a practice similar to this performed with these very offerings. The Thracian and Paeonian women, whenever they sacrifice to Artemis the queen, never do so without having wheat straw accompanying their offerings. This I know these women do. As for the maidens from the Hyperboreans who died at Delos, the Delian children, girls and boys alike, cut their hair in mourning for them. The girls, before marriage, cut off a lock and wind it around a spindle, and place it upon the tomb. This tomb lies within the sanctuary of Artemis, as one enters on the left, and an olive tree grows upon it. While as many of the Delian boys as there are wind some of their hair around a green shoot, and likewise place it upon the tomb. Such is the honor these maidens receive from the inhabitants of Delos. The same people also say that Arge and Opis, being maidens from the Hyperboreans, traveled by way of these same peoples and arrived at Delos even before Hyperosh and Laiatis. These latter came bringing to Eileithyia the tribute they had pledged in exchange for easy childbirth. But Arge and Opis, they say, arrived together with the gods themselves, and other honors were given to them by the Delians. For the women collect contributions for them, naming their names in the hymn composed for them by Olin, a Lycian man, and it is from these people that the islanders and the Ionians learn to sing hymns naming Opis and Arge, invoking them by name and collecting contributions. This same Olin, having come from Lycia, also composed the other ancient hymns that are sung at Delos. And when the thigh bones are burned upon the altar, this ash is used, being cast upon the tomb of Opis and Arge. Their tomb lies behind the sanctuary of Artemis, facing east, very close to the banqueting hall of the scenes. Let this much be said concerning the Hyperboreans, for the story about Abaris, who is said to have been a Hyperborean, I will not tell, how he carried his arrow around the whole earth eating nothing at all. But if there are indeed some people beyond the north, there are also others beyond the south. I laugh when I see that many have already drawn maps of the world, and yet none has explained it sensibly. They draw ocean flowing around the earth, which they make circular as though shaped on a lathe, while treating Asia as equal in size to Europe. I will show in brief compass the size of each of them and what each is like for the purposes of a map. The Persians dwell reaching down to the southern sea, called the Red Sea. Above them, toward the north wind, dwell the Medes, above the Medes the Saspers, above the Saspers the Colchians, who reach up to the sea in the north, the one into which the Phases River empties. These four peoples occupy the land from sea to sea. From there, westward, two peninsulas stretch out from it to the sea, which I will now describe. On one side, the first peninsula, on the north, beginning from the Phases, extends to the sea running alongside the Pontus and on to the Hellespont, reaching as far as Sigeum in the Troad. On the south side, this same peninsula extends from the Mariandic Gulf, which lies near Phoenicia, to the sea as far as the Triopian headland. There dwell in this peninsula 30 nations of men. This, then, is the one of the two peninsulas. The other, beginning from the Persians, extends to the Red Sea, first the Persian territory, then, taking over from it, the Assyrian, and after Assyria, Arabia. This peninsula ends, though it does not truly end except by convention, at the Arabian Gulf, into the one that Darius brought in from the Nile as a canal. Now as far as Phoenicia, the region running from the Persians is broad and extensive. From Phoenicia onward, this coastline runs along the sea past Syria, Palestine, and Egypt, where it ends. In it there are only 3 nations. This, then, is what lies to the west of Asia as reckoned from the Persians. Above the Persians and Medes and Saspers and Colchians, toward the east and the rising sun, lies the region where the Red Sea extends, and to the north lie the Caspian Sea and the Araxes River, its current running toward the sunrise. Asia is inhabited as far as India, but beyond that, toward the east, it is already desert, and no one can say what sort of place it is. Such then and so great is Asia. Libya lies on the other coastline, for after Egypt, Libya immediately follows. Now at Egypt this coastline is narrow. From this sea to the Red Sea it is 100,000 fathoms, which would be 1,000 stadia. But beyond this narrow neck, the coastline called Libya turns out to be very broad indeed. I am amazed, then, at those who have marked out and divided Libya, Asia, and Europe, for the differences between them are not small. In length Europe extends alongside both of the others, but in breadth it does not seem to me worthy even of comparison. For Libya shows itself to be surrounded by sea, except for the part where it borders Asia, a fact first demonstrated, as far as we know, by Necho, king of the Egyptians. He, after he ceased digging the canal linking the Nile to the Arabian Gulf, dispatched Phoenician crews by ship, instructing them to sail back through the Pillars of Heracles until they reached the Northern Sea, and so returned to Egypt. So the Phoenicians set out from the Red Sea and sailed the Southern Sea. Whenever autumn came, they would put into whatever part of Libya they were passing and plant crops there, and wait for the harvest. Then, having reaped the grain, they continued their voyage, with the result that 2 full years passed before, in the 3rd year, they rounded the Pillars of Heracles and arrived in Egypt. And they reported something I do not believe, though someone else might, that as they rounded Libya, the sun stood to their right hand. In this way, this land was first discovered. After that, the Carthaginians are the ones who report on it. As for Sadasps, son of Tespes, a man of the Achaemenid clan, he did not sail around Libya, though he was sent for that very purpose, but turned back out of fear of the length of the voyage and the desolation, and went back home, and did not accomplish the task his mother had laid upon him. For he had raped Zopyrus, son of Megabyzus's daughter, still unmarried. Then, facing impalement by King Xerxes on account of this crime, his mother, who was Darius's sister, interceded for him, saying that she herself would impose a greater penalty on him than that, for he would be compelled to sail around Libya until he arrived at the Arabian Gulf by sailing around it. Xerxes having agreed to these terms, Sadasps went to Egypt, and taking a ship and crew from the Egyptians, sailed to the Pillars of Heracles. Having sailed through them and rounded the headland of Libya called Salois, he sailed toward the south. And after crossing much sea over many months, since he always needed still more, he turned around and sailed back to Egypt. From there he went to King Xerxes and reported that at the farthest point he had sailed past small men who wore garments of palm fiber, who, whenever he put in with his ship, fled to the mountains, abandoning their towns. But his men did no harm entering the towns, only taking food from them. And he said the reason he did not sail all the way around Libya was this, that the ship could no longer go forward but was stuck fast. Xerxes did not believe he was telling the truth, and since he had not completed the task set for him, he impaled him, carrying out the original sentence. As for this Sadasps eunuch, he fled to Samos as soon as he learned that his master had died, taking great wealth with him, which a man of Samos seized, a man whose name I know well but intentionally forget. Most of Asia was explored by Darius, who, wishing to know where the Indus River, which is the second of all rivers to produce crocodiles, empties into the sea, sent by ship, among others whom he trusted to report the truth, a man named Silax of Carianda. They set out from the city of Caspatiris and the land of Pactiaca, and sailed down the river toward the east and the rising sun to the sea, and then sailing through the sea toward the west, in the 30th month they arrived at that place from which the king of Egypt, as I said before, had sent out the Phoenicians to sail around Libya. After these men had made this circuit, Darius subdued the Indians and made use of that sea. Thus for Asia too, except for the parts toward the rising sun, everything else has been found to be similar in nature to Libya. But Europe is not clearly known by anyone, neither to the east nor to the north, whether it is surrounded by sea. In length it is known to extend alongside both of the others. Nor can I understand for what reason, though it is one land, it bears 3 names, all named after women, and its boundaries were set as the Nile, the River of Egypt, and the Phases, the River of Colchis, though some say instead the River Tanais, the Miesian, and the Cimmerian ferries. nor can I learn the names of those who marked out these divisions, or where they got the names. For Libya is said by most Greeks to take its name from Libya, a native woman, while Asia takes its name from the wife of Prometheus. And of this name the Lydians also lay claim, saying that Asia was named after Asai's son of Cotys son of Manes, and not after Prometheus's Asia. And from this the tribe at Sardis is also called Asias. But Europe, whether it is surrounded by sea is not known by anyone, nor where it got this name, nor who it was that gave it, unless we say that the land took its name from Tyrian Europa. Before that it was, it seems, nameless like the other two. But she at least clearly came from Asia, and never came to this land which the Greeks now call Europe, but only as far as from Phoenicia to Crete, and from Crete to Lycia. This much, then, let this suffice to say, for we shall use the names as they are conventionally applied. Now the Black Sea, against which Darius made his campaign, contains, apart from the Scythian nation, the most ignorant peoples of all lands. For we cannot point to any nation within the Black Sea region as distinguished for wisdom, nor do we know of any learned man having arisen there, except for the Scythian nation and Anacharsis. But for the Scythian race, one thing, the greatest of all human affairs, has been discovered more cleverly than by any people we know, though I do not admire the rest of their ways. This greatest thing has been contrived by them so that no one who invades them can escape, and if they choose not to be discovered, catching them becomes impossible. For they have neither founded cities nor walls, but all of them, carrying their homes with them, are mounted archers, living not by plowing but by herding cattle, and their dwellings are on wagons. How then could these people not be unbeatable and impossible to engage in battle? This has been contrived by them because the land is suited to it, and the rivers are their allies. For this land, being flat, is grassy and well watered, and rivers flow through it not much fewer in number than the canals in Egypt. Of these, those that are notable and navigable from the sea I shall name: the Ister with five mouths, then the Tyras, the Hypanes, the Borysthenes, the Panticapes, the Hypasiris, the Gerhis, and the Tanais. These flow as follows. The Ister, being the greatest of all rivers we know, flows equal in volume both summer and winter. And being the first of the rivers in Scythia as one comes from the west, it has become the greatest for the following reason. There are other rivers flowing into it that make it great. Through the Scythian land itself there flow five. The one the Scythians call Porata and the Greeks call Pyratis, and another, the Tyrantis, and the Araros and the Naparis and the Ordesis. The first named of these rivers is large and, flowing eastward, joins its waters with the Ister. The second named, the Tyrantis, flows more toward the west and is smaller, while the Araros and the Naparis and the Ordesis, flowing between these, empty into the Ister. These are native Scythian rivers that swell it, and from the Agathiasi the river Maris flows and joins the Ister, while from the peaks of Hemus three other great rivers, flowing toward the north wind, empty into it: the Atlas, the Oras, and the Tibisis. Flowing through Thrace and through the land of the Thracian Crobisi, the Athres, the Nos, and the Artins empty into the Ister, and from the Paeonians and Mount Rhodope, the river Schis, splitting Mount Hemus down the middle, empties into it. From the Illyrians, flowing toward the north wind, the river Angrus flows into the Triballic plain, joining the river Brongus, which in turn joins the Ister. So the Ister takes in both of these mighty streams. And from the country above, home to the Ambraci, come the river Carpis and a second river, the Alpes, flowing toward the north wind, and these two empty into it. For the Ister flows through the whole of Europe, beginning among the Celts, who, apart from the Sinites, are the westernmost people living in Europe. And flowing through the whole of Europe, it discharges into the flanks of Scythia. It is from these rivers named, and from many others contributing their own water, that the Ister ranks as the largest of all rivers by volume. Though measured strictly water against water, the Nile actually holds more, since no river or spring adds a comparable amount to the Nile's flow. Yet the Ister keeps a constant level year-round, in both summer and winter, for a reason that seems to me as follows. In winter it holds exactly as much as it naturally is, or only a little larger than its natural size. For this land is rained on very little in winter, and instead gets snow throughout. But in summer the abundant snow that fell in winter, melting from every side, flows down into the Ister. So this snow, discharging into it, swells its volume, together with many violent rainstorms that accompany it, for it does rain in summer. And in proportion as the sun draws up more water to itself in summer than in winter, by that much the tributaries that mix with the Ister are many times more abundant in summer than in winter. These two effects, set against each other, balance out, so that the river always appears the same size. So the Ister is one of the rivers belonging to the Scythians, and after it the Tiras, which rises from the north wind and begins to flow from a great lake that forms the border between the Scythian land and that of the Neuri. At its mouth dwell Greeks called Tirati. Third is the river Hypanes, which rises in Scythia and flows from a great lake around which graze wild white horses, and this lake is rightly called the mother of the Hypanes. Rising from it, the river Hypanes flows for a 5 days' sail short and sweet, but from there to the sea, for a 4 days' sail, it is dreadfully bitter. For a bitter spring flows into it, so very bitter that although small in size it corrupts the Hypanes, otherwise a great river, into one of the few bitter ones. This spring lies on the borders of the land of the Scythian farmers and the Alizones. In Scythian, this spring and the place it rises from are called Exampius, while the Greek name for it is the Sacred Ways. The Tiras and the Hypanes draw close together at their upper courses near the Alizones, then after that each turns away and flows apart, widening the space between them. Fourth is the river Borysthenes, which is the greatest after the Ister among these, and in my judgment the most productive not only of the Scythian rivers but of all others, except the Egyptian Nile. For with the Nile no other river can be compared. But among the rest, the Borysthenes is the most productive, providing the finest and richest pastures for cattle, and excellent fish in abundance beyond all others. Its water is the sweetest to drink, and it flows clear beside other rivers that are turbid. The finest crops grow beside it, and where the land is not sown, the grass grows the deepest. At its mouth, salt forms of its own accord in vast quantities, and it yields great boneless fish, which they call antiche, fit for salting, along with many other things worth wondering at. As far as the region of the Gerhi, a 40 days' sail up, it is known to flow from the north wind. But beyond that, no one can say through what peoples it flows. It appears to flow through desert until it reaches the land of the farming Scythians. These Scythians occupy its banks for a stretch of 10 days' sailing. Of this river, together with the Nile, I cannot state where its sources lie, and I doubt any Greek can either. The Borysthenes, as it flows near the sea, meets the Hypanes, which pours into the same marsh with it. The land between these two rivers, a spit jutting into the country, is called Cape Hippolaus, and on it stands a temple of Demeter, and across the strait from the temple, on the Hypanes, the Borysthenites dwell. So much for what concerns these rivers. After them comes a fifth river, named the Panticapes, which likewise flows from the north out of a lake, and the land between it and the Borysthenes is occupied by the farming Scythians. It discharges into the Hylia, and after passing through it joins the Borysthenes. Sixth is the river Hypaserus, which rises from a lake, and flowing through the middle of the nomadic Scythians discharges near the city of Carcinitis, keeping to its right the Hylia and the so-called course of Achilles. Seventh is the river Gerhis, which branches off from the Borysthenes at the point in the land where the Borysthenes becomes known. It branches off from that point and bears the same name as the place itself, Gerhis. Flowing to the sea, it forms the boundary between the land of the nomads and that of the royal Scythians, and it discharges into the Hypaserus. Eighth is the river Tanais, which flows down from far above, issuing from a great lake, and discharges into a still greater lake called the Miesian, which separates the royal Scythians from the Sauromati. Into this Tanais another river flows, named the Hyages. With such rivers, then, of note, the Scythians are equipped. As for their livestock, the grass that grows up in Scythia is the most bowl-producing of all grasses we know, and when the cattle are opened up, one can judge from this that it is so. So they are amply provided with the greatest necessities. The rest of their customs are arranged as follows. They propitiate only these gods, Hestia above all, and then Zeus and Earth, believing Earth to be the wife of Zeus, and after them Apollo, and heavenly Aphrodite, and Heracles, and Ares. All the Scythians hold these gods, but the so-called royal Scythians also sacrifice to Poseidon. In the Scythian tongue, Hestia is called Tabidi, Zeus, most rightly in my judgment, is called Papias. Earth is Api, Apollo is Godesiris, heavenly Aphrodite is Argempasa, and Poseidon is Thagimasadas. It is not their custom to make images, altars, or temples, except to Ares, to him they do make them. The same manner of sacrifice is established for all their rites alike, performed as follows. The victim itself stands with its forefeet bound together, and the sacrificer, standing behind the animal, pulls the end of the cord and throws it down. As the victim falls, he calls upon whichever god he is sacrificing to, and then, having cast a noose around its neck, he inserts a stick and turns it, strangling the animal, without kindling a fire, without a preliminary offering, and without a libation. Having strangled it and skinned it, he turns to boiling it. Since the Scythian land is remarkably lacking in wood, this is the method they have devised for boiling the meat. Once they have skinned the victims, they strip the meat from the bones, then throw it in, if they happen to have them, into local cauldrons very much resembling lesbian mixing bowls, except much larger. Throwing the meat into these, they boil it, burning the bones of the victims beneath as fuel. But if they do not have the cauldron on hand, they throw all the meat into the bellies of the victims, add water, and burn the bones beneath. The bones burn very well, and the bellies easily hold the meat once stripped from the bones. And so the ox boils itself, and each of the other victims boils itself as well. When the meat is boiled, the sacrificer, taking a first portion of the meat and of the entrails, throws it in front of him. They sacrifice other livestock too, and horses most of all. To the other gods they sacrifice in this manner, and with these animals, but the rite for Ares differs. Within every district, at the seat of each ruling territory, they have established a shrine to Ares of this sort. Bundles of brushwood are heaped up over an area of about 3 stadia in length and breadth, though less in height. On top of this, a square platform has been made, and 3 of its sides are sheer, while on the 4th side it can be climbed. Each year they pile 150 wagon loads of brushwood onto it, for it is always settling from the weather. On this mound, an ancient iron sword is set up for each community, and this is the image of Ares. To this sword, they bring yearly sacrifices of sheep and horses, and indeed they sacrifice more to it than to the other gods. And from whatever captives they seize among their enemies, 1 man in 100 is offered up, done differently from how the livestock are slaughtered. For after pouring wine over their heads, they cut the men's throats over a vessel, and then, carrying the blood up onto the pile of brushwood, they pour it over the sword. That is what they carry up above, and down below, beside the shrine, they do the following. Cutting off the right arms of all the slaughtered men at the shoulder, together with the hands, they toss them upward, and once the remaining offerings are completed, they withdraw. The arm lies wherever it falls, and the corpse lies apart from it. Such then are their established sacrifices. Of pigs they make no use at all, and they are unwilling to raise them in their land in any way. As for matters of war, their customs are arranged as follows. Once a Scythian fells his first opponent, he tastes a bit of the man's blood, and for every enemy slain in battle afterward, he brings the severed head to the king. For if he brings back the head, he shares in the spoils they have taken, but if he does not bring it, he gets none. He flays it in this way. Cutting round the ears, he takes hold of the head and shakes it out. Then, having stripped the flesh with an ox rib, he works the skin soft with his hands, and once he has kneaded it, he keeps it as a hand towel and hangs it on the bridle of his own mount, taking pride in the trophy, for whoever has the most skin hand towels is judged the best man. Many of them also make cloaks to wear out of the skins, stitching them together like herdsmen's cloaks. Many, too, flay the right hands of dead enemies, nails and all, and make covers for their quivers out of them. Human skin, it turns out, is thick and glossy, brighter than almost any other skin, the most brilliant in whiteness. Many also flay whole men, and stretching the skins on frames of wood, carry them about on horseback. Such are their customs. As for the heads themselves, not of all enemies, but of the most hated, they do the following. Each man saws off the whole part below the eyebrows and cleans it out. And if he is poor, he merely stretches raw oxhide around the outside and uses it as it is. But if he is rich, he stretches the raw hide around it and then gilds the inside as well and drinks from it as a cup. The same is done even with kin, should they turn into enemies and the man prevails over him before the king. And when guests come whom he holds in regard, he brings out these heads and explains that these were his own kinsmen who started a war against him, and that he himself prevailed over them, counting this as a mark of manly valor. Once each year, every district governor, in his own district, mixes a bowl of wine, from which those Scythians who have killed enemies drink. But those who have not accomplished this do not taste of that wine, but sit apart in dishonor, and this is for them the greatest disgrace. But as many of them as have killed a very great number of men drink from two cups at once, holding both together. There are many diviners among the Scythians, who divine with a great many willow rods in this manner. When they have brought great bundles of rods, they lay them on the ground and unroll them, and setting them out one rod at a time, they utter their prophecy. And as they speak, they gather the rods back together again and put them back one by one. This is their ancestral method of divination. But the Enares, the man-woman diviners, say that Aphrodite gave them the art of divination, and they divine by the bark of the linden tree. When they split a strip of linden bark into three, they weave it between their own fingers and, unweaving it, give their oracle. Whenever the king of the Scythians falls ill, he sends for the three most reputed of the diviners, who divine in the manner described, and these say, for the most part, something like this, claiming that a particular citizen, whichever one they name, has broken his oath sworn on the royal hearth. It is the Scythian custom to swear especially by the royal hearth whenever they wish to swear the greatest oath. And at once the man they say has sworn falsely is seized and brought in bound, and when he arrives the diviners charge him, saying that he plainly appears, by their art of divination, to have sworn falsely by the royal hearth, and that this is the cause of the king's suffering. And he denies it, saying he did not swear falsely, and protests loudly. Once he denies the charge, the king summons a second group of diviners, double the number, and if they likewise, through their divination, find him guilty of perjury, they cut off his head at once, and the first diviners divide his property among themselves. But if the diviners who come afterward acquit him, other diviners come, and yet others again. If then, the majority acquit the man, it has been decided that the first diviners themselves must perish. And they put them to death in this way. When they have filled a wagon with brushwood and yoked oxen to it, they tie the diviners' hands behind them, stop up their mouths, wedge them into the center of the brushwood pile, and set it on fire, they let the oxen loose, terrifying them. Many oxen are burned up together with the diviners, and many escape scorched all over, when the pole of the wagon burns through. For other offenses, too, they burn diviners this same way, branding them false prophets. And those whom the king puts to death, he does not even leave their sons alive, but kills all the males, while doing no harm to the females. Oaths are made by the Scythians in this way toward those with whom they make them. Pouring wine into a large earthenware cup, they mix in it the blood of those swearing the oath, pricking the body with an awl or making a small cut with a knife, and then a short sword, some arrows, a battle axe, and a javelin are dipped into the mixture. And when they have done this, they utter many prayers over it, and then those making the oath drink it down themselves, along with the most worthy of their followers. The burials of the kings are at Gerhai, as far as the Borysthenes is navigable. There, when the king dies, they dig a great four-sided pit in the ground, and having made it ready, they take up the corpse, its body coated in wax, its belly slit open and cleansed, and filled with chopped cypress, incense, celery seed, and anise seed, then sewn back up, and they carry it in a wagon to another tribe. Those who receive the corpse brought to them do just as the royal Scythians do. They cut off a piece of their ear, shave off their hair, cut their arms, gash their forehead and nose, and drive an arrow through their left hand. From there they carry the king's body onward in the wagon to another tribe of those they rule, and the people they had previously visited follow along with them. And when they have carried the corpse around to all the tribes, they arrive at Gerhai, which is the farthest inhabited of the tribes they rule and where the burial grounds are. And then, once they have laid the corpse in the tomb on a bed of reeds, they fix spears upright on either side of the body and lay timbers across them, and then roof it over with wicker mats. And in the remaining open space of the tomb, they strangle and bury one of the king's concubines, and his cupbearer, his cook, his groom, his personal attendant, his messenger, and horses and first fruits of everything else, and golden cups, for they use neither silver nor bronze. Having done this, they all heap up a great mound, vying and striving eagerly with one another to make it as large as possible. Then, when a year has come round, they do the following again. Taking the most suitable of the remaining servants, these are native-born Scythians, for they serve whomever the king himself commands, and they have no servants bought with silver. They strangle 50 of these attendants and 50 of the finest horses, and having removed their entrails and cleaned them out, they fill them with chaff and sew them up again. Then, setting half of a wheel's rim upright on two posts, and the other half of the rim on two other posts, and fixing many such frames in this way, they then drive thick pieces of wood through the horses lengthwise up to their necks and mount them on the frames. And of these, the front frames support the shoulders of the horses, while the rear ones bear up the bellies near the thighs, and both pairs of legs hang free in the air. And having put bits and bridles on the horses, they stretch them forward and tie them fast to stakes. Then they mount one each of the 50 strangled young men on the horses, mounting them in this way. When they have driven a straight piece of wood through each corpse alongside the spine up to the neck, the lower part of this wood, which projects below, they fix into a socket in the other piece of wood that runs through the horse. Having set up such horsemen in a circle around the tomb, they ride away. Thus then they bury the kings. As for the other Scythians, whenever they die, their nearest relatives carry them around lying in wagons among their friends, and each of these, receiving them, feasts those who accompany the corpse, and sets before the dead man a share of everything just as he sets before the others. In this way, commoners are paraded about across 40 days before finally being laid to rest. After burying, the Scythians purify themselves in this manner. Having washed and rinsed their heads, they do the following to their bodies. They set up three poles leaning together toward one another and stretch felt mats around them, and packing them together as tightly as possible, they throw red-hot stones into a basin set in the middle of the poles and the felts. There grows in their country a hemp very like flax except in thickness and height, and in this the hemp far surpasses it. It grows both wild and cultivated, and from it the Thracians make garments very like linen ones. Indeed, no one who was not very practiced at it could tell whether it was linen or hemp. Someone who has not yet laid eyes on hemp would take the garment for linen. Now once the Scythians gather the seed of this hemp plant, they crawl in beneath their felt tents, and then cast the seed onto stones heated red-hot in the fire. And once thrown on, it smolders and produces a vapor so thick that no vapor bath in Greece could match it. The Scythians, thrilled by the vapor, cry out. This takes the place of bathing for them, since they never wash their bodies in water at all. Their women, meanwhile, pour out water and rub it into a rough stone along with cypress, cedar, and frankincense wood, and afterward they smear this thick paste over their whole body and face. A fragrance then settles over them from this, and when on the next day they remove the plaster, they become clean and radiant. As for foreign customs, they too shun adopting them very strongly, none at all, but especially Greek ones, as Anacharsis showed, and after him Siles again. For Anacharsis, after he had observed much of the world, and in the course of it, displayed great wisdom, was on his way home. Anacharsis was sailing through the Hellespont toward Scythia when he put in at Cyzicus. There he found the people of Cyzicus holding a magnificent festival in honor of the mother of the gods, and Anacharsis made a vow to her. If he came home safely to his own country, he would offer sacrifice to her exactly as he had watched the Cyzicenes do, and would hold an all-night vigil in her honor. Once he reached Scythia, he went down into the district called the Hylia, which lies along the racecourse of Achilles and happens to be entirely covered with woods of every kind. And there, having gone down into it, Anacharsis performed the whole rite for the goddess, holding a hand drum and hanging images on himself. One of the Scythians observed him doing this and reported it to King Solius. The king himself came, and when he saw Anacharsis while doing this, an arrow struck him down. Even now, if anyone brings up Anacharsis, the Scythians claim they do not know him, on the grounds that he had gone off to Greece and taken up foreign ways. Yet according to what I heard from Timnes, steward to Areopides, Anacharsis was uncle to Eidentheusus, king of the Scythians, and his father was Gonurus, son of Lycus, son of Spargopides. If then Anacharsis truly came from this house, one should know he died at his own brother's hand. For Eidentheusus was Solius's son, and Solius was the one who killed Anacharsis. Still, I have heard a different version circulated among the Peloponnesians, that Anacharsis was dispatched by the Scythian king to learn in Greece, and upon his return, told the man who sent him that the Greeks were all preoccupied with every branch of knowledge except the Lacedaemonians, and that they alone knew how to give and receive speech with restraint. But this story has been invented out of nothing by the Greeks themselves, and the man, as was said before, was actually killed. This, then, is how that man fared, because of his foreign customs and his associations with Greeks. Many years later, Syles, son of Areopides, suffered something very similar. For Areopides, the Scythian king, had a son named Syles among his other children, born of a mother from Istria rather than a native woman, and it was this mother who taught him Greek speech and writing. Later on, Areopides met his end through treachery at the hands of Spargopides, ruler of the Agathiaceae, and Syles inherited both the throne and his father's wife, whose name was Apia. This Apia was a native woman, and by her Areopides had a son, Oricus. Now Syles, while ruling as king of the Scythians, was in no way pleased with the Scythian way of life, but was far more inclined toward Greek ways, owing to the upbringing he had received. He used to do the following. Whenever he brought the Scythian army to the city of the Borysthenites, these Borysthenites claimed to be Milesians. Whenever Syles came among them, he would leave the army in the suburb, and he himself, once inside the walls with the gates shut, would take off his Scythian dress and put on Greek clothing, and wearing it he would walk about the marketplace with neither bodyguards nor anyone else accompanying him. And the gatekeepers guarded the gates so that no Scythian might see him wearing this dress. In every other respect, too, he followed the Greek way of life and offered sacrifices to the gods according to Greek customs. Whenever he had spent a month or more there, he would depart, putting his Scythian dress back on. He did this often, and he even built a house in Borysthenes and married a native woman there. But when it was fated that things would go badly for him, it happened for the following reason. He grew eager to be initiated into the rites of Dionysus Bacchus, and just as he was about to undergo the initiation, an enormous sign appeared to him. In the town of the Borysthenites, he owned a walled compound belonging to a grand and expensive house, which I noted just before this, ringed by sphinxes and griffins carved from white stone. A bolt from the god struck this building. It burned to the ground completely, yet Syles still went ahead and finished the rite anyway. The Scythians taunt the Greeks over this Bacchic practice, insisting it makes no sense to invent a god who drives people into frenzy. Once Syles had undergone the Bacchic initiation, a certain Borysthenite went and informed the Scythians, saying, "You mock us, Scythians, for holding Bacchic rites and letting the god take hold of us. Well now, this very spirit has seized your own king as well, and he revels in Bacchic frenzy, driven mad by the god. If you doubt my word, come along, and I will point him out to you." The Scythian chiefs went along with him, and the man from Borysthenes brought them up quietly and placed them on a tower. When Syles passed by in the company of his revelers, and the Scythians caught sight of him in his frenzy, they were struck by a great distress, and going out they reported to the whole army what they had seen. After this, when Syles set out to return to his own quarters, the Scythians, putting forward his brother Octomasades, who was the son of the daughter of Teres, rose up against Syles. He, learning what was happening against him and the reason for it, fled for refuge into Thrace. Octomasades, learning of this, Octomasades set out to campaign against Thrace with these forces. When he reached the Ister, the Thracians met him there, and just as the two sides were about to clash, Sitalces sent word to Octomasades with this message. "Why should we put each other to the test? You have my sister's son with you, and I hold your uncle. Return him to me, and I will hand your Syles over to you, and let neither of our armies risk battle." Sitalces sent this message to him through a herald, for a brother of Sitalces had fled and was with Octomasades. Octomasades agreed to this, and handing over his own maternal uncle to Sitalces, he received his brother Syles in exchange. Sitalces took his brother and led him away, but Octomasades cut off the head of Syles right there. This is how the Scythians guard their own customs, and such are the penalties they impose on those who adopt foreign customs in addition to their own.